Welcome to the latest edition of Take Note. This is our podcast where we talk about taking notes in our notebooks that we try to carry around with us wherever we go so that when we have interesting thoughts or observe something compelling in the world or hear our children say something funny, that we have the wherewithal to write those things down and then the wherewithal to read them to each other on this podcast. And of course, I read these things to Adam. Hello, Adam.
Hey, Ted. That doesn't sound convoluted whatsoever. I've got two words for you, and I wonder if you know what they mean. Careless whiskers.
Is that the 12th novel in the series of cat murder mysteries that introduced us to last week?
It is the just-announced 2020 novel by just Miranda announced. James. Well, I don't know. The one that I just found. From the Cat in the Stacks mystery series following... Angry Librarians, 12 Angry Librarians, Cause for Concern, Six Cats a Slayin'. I was so excited when I found Careless Whiskers. I don't even know how I found it. I can't remember looking for it. It's like I just woke up and it was there.
Amazing.
Yeah.
It might be that you signed up for the email newsletter and subscribed to her Tumblr blog.
And I want to be clear. I'm not making fun of these books.
Clarity is critical in moments like this.
Because for them to be mystery novels about cats, they must be really, really good. Because it's such a strange premise.
Ted, I feel like that's a long tradition of murder mysteries involving cats, though. I'm not ready to say that it's quite as as unique as you're making it out. Tickled though you may be by these wonderful, wonderful puns that grace the covers of these books, I feel like there's a series, like the, you know, M is for Murder, like that whole series, whatever that thing was.
That's not about a cat.
But I feel like there was cat heavy, cat forward. What,
cat forward?
I'm not going to say it was only cats in the way that Six Bells are Ringing went.
my son Logan is really, he's in like a real deep Garfield phase. In fact, just before we were recording, he was like sitting 6 feet away from me, and he was sitting around the corner, he couldn't see me, and he just couldn't stop laughing at Garfield. And then finally he stopped laughing and he says to himself, I love it. So I think maybe I can, you know, as he gets a little older, maybe he'll like these Miranda James Cat in the Stacks books.
Well, one day when he's come of age, you can sit him down and say, son, I've been waiting a long time to show you this, but I feel you're ready. Just drop those self-published books right on the bed.
It's an orange cat on the cover. I could say that like it's just in the adult Garfields. Garfield is a detective.
Garfield grown up.
Inspector Garfield.
Well, isn't Garfield already? He's already kind of grown up.
Yes,
I'm with you. Yes. I love it. All right, Adam. Now it's time for our segment that we like to call What Do You Got? Because we ask each other, what do you got? And then we read what you got. So, Adam, what do you got?
All right. I wrote this. This is a dialogue. All right. I was wondering if we can get a late checkout. Okay, yeah, you can check out at 12. Could we get a late checkout? The sign in the room says checkout is 12. That's right. Checkout is at 11. The latest you can check out is 12. So is this lady, Ted, is this lady suggesting that the earliest checkout is 11? And how did I walk into some sort of like Kafka-esque hotel where they just don't answer the question?
Oh, she's good.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on her side on this one.
It was hard not to be on. She was so good that I was like, you really got me. This is nice.
Yeah. You got like she introduced an entirely new concept of a checkout range.
Right.
Without at any point naming that entirely new concept, but by merely behaving in a manner that suggests that everybody already knows that concept.
The other thing that made me feel like this was a strange Kafka-esque situation is that when I went to check the door where the checkout time was posted, I saw that the room rates were listed at $10,000 each. And... you know, this was a small Marriott discount chain.
Of course, that is the most that you can pay for a hotel room. The least that you can pay is $99.
Just with the checkout time, yeah.
That's fantastic.
Ted, what do you got?
All right, let's see. Drew a happy face in the margins of a very funny book, and was thoroughly displeased with it. Should I practice? I thought. It's very easy to draw a terribly unsatisfying happy face or sad face. It's like, what did Mark Twain say? You know, writing 3,000 words is easy. What's really hard is to write 300 words. Well, I mean, what is a happy face if not a human emotion distilled down into three simple marks that I wasn't having my own version of?
I think when you master the happy face, you should work on a spiral. And that'll disappoint you. That's very hard.
What else you got, Adam?
Go. All right. So a few months ago, my son Logan was working on writing projects. So we were working on his writing together. And he decided he wanted to write a letter to a bakery that we had visited on spring break. And this is one of the probably the most famous bakeries in the country. So he writes this letter saying how much he liked the desserts there and how much he liked visiting there and asking the chef to open a location in Chicago. And like I said, it's a couple months ago. This morning, we're trying to get out the door, get Logan to camp and get his brother to camp. And doorbell rings. And there is a giant box from this bakery that's been FedExed overnight that's filled with Logan's favorite dessert that he wrote about and a bunch of other desserts and the cookbook from the bakery. And we open it up, and it's signed by the chef in this like amazing, intricate, dramatic script with some sort of fountain pen with a big brush. And it says, Logan, it's all about memories.
That's fantastic. Well, I love that it's centered around letter writing and that handwriting plays a big part, and that it was you're encouraging him to write, and then he gets this amazing kind of feedback loop to close out a writing project. I love that story.
Yeah, it's really something, and it's nice that I mean, we were working on it because it was a challenge for him. And so to have this amazing reward is really something. And also, I mean, the thing that just got me is like, it's like from hundreds of miles away, just in a letter that was, you know, hey, we need to find something to write. And that's what he wanted to write. That the chef kind of got the measure of our child, maybe more than I did, if only because I knew he'd like the book, but I didn't think it would like grab him as much. And like, he can't stop talking about the cookbook, you know?
Well, I mean, there's something about... Okay, he's a famous chef, but what he's done is project his passion outward towards people who then can tap into it, which, I mean, I think you're sort of experiencing that too, but I think that's a powerful lesson, and I think it's a great writing project because it's not just writing for the sake of writing something down and not giving it any life, but it's writing as a way to reach out to people and to connect with someone and to give someone an unsolicited compliment, and which is, I mean, the older I get, the more I realize that unsolicited compliments might be one of the more satisfying things that people can do on the sliding scale. And it just can be a source of pleasure and connection and energy that's what I love about your story is that chef knows the energy. He gets the energy.
Right.
Both ways. That's fantastic.
Ted, what do you got?
All right. So I went to the Menil collection, MENIL, which is one of Houston, Texas's most iconic museums. And they had a show up by artist Mineko Grimmer.
Oh, yeah, Mineko Grimmer.
Yeah. Grimmy Grims. It's a It's called Remembering Plato from 1992. It's a room size installation. You walk behind a curtain. A sign says this is a silent exhibition. And my wife had been, so she introduced me to the idea. So I knew somewhat what I was walking into. But it was two installations on either side of this modest sized room, kind of very dark, but not pitch dark, you know, well lit, but super mellow. And it was two pyramids of rocks frozen in ice hanging sort of point down. And below these frozen rock pyramids, small, you know, maybe 8 inches across, were piano wire strung across a water tank, like a little, you know, like a pool, water pool. So there's one of these on either side. And it was just this amazing meditative space to really stop, sit, stare at whatever this was, whatever you could call this. Basically, more or less waiting for a little pebble to melt from out of this pyramid and drop onto this piano wire and see what happens. So after I staggered out of there, probably 15 minutes later, I took some notes. And these are actually on the brochure for the show, because I was in the hallway of the museum, but it somehow felt weird to like pull out a notebook and make a big display of writing things. I always feel like I'm going to get tackled by it.
You're never going to be the weirdest guy in the museum.
That's fair. But here are some of my notes. I'm not sure if they'll make much sense. Branches equal two strings. And my act depends on rocks in ice. The waiting is all of life. And then the sound, what heard that? Which is kind of a reference to an old Zen thing I saw in a video where if you say, you clap, and you say, what heard that sound? And that's kind of what Zen is like trying to find that part of you that heard a shout or a sound. And watching this piano wire throng and then really being taken into that world. And then I went into the surrealism exhibit, which is a lot of the old standards, Max Ernst and René Magritte and Miro and some Cornell boxes, actually.
I'm a big fan of the Cornell boxes.
Fantastic. I know. That's why I said that special lilty way. But I got out of there and I wrote Surrealism. Art as a messenger delivering a veiled message. Like, I don't know. I was feeling how the surrealists are sending you a message, but they were not necessarily going to tell you what the message was, or maybe they didn't even know what it was. But somehow there was a message that needed to be delivered. I don't know. It was an enjoyable experience. If you're in Houston, you have to go to the Manil. I've been recommending it to everyone I speak to. But it's free, and you just wander in, and it's really world-class stuff. But I was an antenna that day. I really felt like I was I was reading the waves that were being put out by the art.
Can I tell you my version of the story?
Please.
Yeah, we were at the Mass Mocha for that Wilco festival. I didn't really talk about the music festival or the art, but I made reservations for us to go to the two James Turrell exhibits, and one each day. You had to make reservations ahead of time. And the first one we went to, we found out that, first off, you could only go in two at a time. Or no, maybe that one you could go in four at a time, but that the four-year-old absolutely could not go in it, so we wouldn't be able to go in at the same time. Whatever, forget that one. The next one, the next day, the four-year-old is going to be allowed to go into. That one you can only go into two at a time. That one is a pitch-black corridor, and you wait 15 minutes for your eyes to adjust. Doesn't sound great. The lady who's in charge of letting it in and out. She explains to us that it's only two people in there at a time, so we decide that me and my 10-year-old son Logan will go in, and then maybe my wife and my 4-year-old will go in, or maybe I'll watch kids and she'll go in. Whatever, we'll figure it out. So Logan and I, you've got your hand against the wall and a hand on the railing trying to find your way. And we get into there and we bump into two people who are walking out. We sit in there for a while, and as my son gets a little bored, and I got a little bored too, I think. we walk out and I say to the lady who's at the front of the exhibit monitoring, I was like, there were two people in there. She's like, ha, ha, ha. It's like, no, I'm not kidding. There were two people in there. She's like, what? Really? I was like, yes. That was our Zen moment of intruders. Wow. Yeah.
Hmm. Yep. Intruders. I like it.
Art intruders.
Let's talk about topics. I was surfing some corner of the internet the other day, and someone just mentioned offhand, I got some time to do some journaling this morning. Super excited. And there was nothing unusual about that, but I thought to myself, journaling. Interesting. You know, obviously they were thinking about pulling out a notebook and doing something with that notebook and writing things down in it. But then I started to wonder or think, well, you know, what we do is not really journaling. We don't, or at least I don't, on a regular basis, sit and kind of unwind the events of the day or kind of pontificate to myself about interrelationships or where my head is at. I think we/I am more in this realm of capturing these snapshots of what goes on around us. So I just thought that might be an interesting topic to sort of explore and contrast maybe journaling or, you know, what we think of as a diary with more of what a little bit of research has revealed to be a commonplace book, which Wikipedia tells me is a way to compile knowledge, usually by writing information into books. Translation of the Latin term locus communis, which means a general or common topic.
Yeah, I suggested that maybe what we do is a commonplace book, but I think it's a stretch, right? So the original commonplace book, just like you said, is people, I think, writing quotes from books that they've read. And maybe you know, pasting pictures in. And does that turn into what we do, which is, I don't know, or what I do, fruit stickers go on a page, and so does a little budget thing in a corner, and there's a to-do list, and there's an email address that I need. Then I saw the word Afrovent somewhere, so that's in there. But for me, I didn't see the word Afrovent. I misread Aerovent and enjoyed the way that I misread it. For me, I think actually that, quote, journaling, whatever that is, that fuels the other thing. If I find a minute in the morning to write down what's going on, or if I am sitting at the coffee shop and my kid is doing something, trying to write a letter, and I write down that that's what's happening, to me that like gives me the fuel later, or the muscle memory, I don't know which metaphor I want to use, to pick up the notebook and write down the little note that I want to make sure to capture. And if I'm not kind of going to that notebook and doing the journaling activity, which for a while was just I walked my dog and I just talked about the tedium of walking the dog, and there was so much walking the dog that that's why I created the notebook prompts email, because I just wanted prompts and they didn't exist, because I wanted to write about anything that wasn't about I walked the dog this morning. But if I don't do that, if I don't find the time to quote journal, then I don't have the tendency to pull the notebook out of my pocket and open it for whatever reason.
This is very interesting, because I think what you're describing in a way is taking that extra time to build a narrative structure, which I mean, in a sense, I think that we, maybe with our short notes at least, we tend to think that we're, that's not what we're doing. But I think what we learned pretty quickly is that even the shortest of notes needs some kind of narrative structure. And I think frequently even we will start reading a note that on our minds is has this narrative flow to it, but then you find quickly that it's halting or it's incomplete or it doesn't unfold in the right way. So I think I find that really interesting what you're saying, to kind of using the act of journaling within the bigger context of keeping these kind of catch-all notebooks as a way to recalibrate your narrative sense, I feel like.
Yeah, and I think it's also just, like, you've got to be willing to write down the dumb, banal stuff. And even if it makes you roll your eyes at yourself, because it just means that you're going to, for me, it makes me grab my notebook more so that,
yeah,
like, I'll write, you know, that I've a few minutes from the morning, so that when I'm in line at the bank, I feel I'm just more likely to, like, pull out the notebook and write, man talking with the bank teller at length about the extraordinary large tumor on the back of his neck/shoulder. And I don't know that I need that, and it's not the sort of thing that I would choose to read in the What Do You Got section of the show, but it's, like, my favorite thing in my notebook because it's bizarre and real and brief and not banal. So,
well, and I like that I kind of set this up as a dichotomy that journaling and what we do are somehow different, but I like that you've very quickly broken down the barriers between those two.
Yeah, there's something about me that will just reject your premise as sport. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
No, it's much appreciated. It's creative tension, and it's fantastic.
So do you not quote journal? Do you not just sit down and write down the dumb stuff?
You know, I think what my tendency is that I will, but that I am always far less satisfied with what I conjure up in an empty moment than with what I, if I see something funny or interesting and write it down. So I think it's kind of like you're saying, where it's mundane, but I find that I go back to it and I find it is still mundane. And that maybe that's a lack of my own imagination, that I'm just transcribing instead of taking an extra two ticks to put some kind of a spin on it that at least I will find interesting later on. But I think, I don't know, my observational notes, where something I hear truly catches my eye and I capture that, those are always more satisfying creatively to me. And that probably speaks to my personality. I mean, I'm the sort who starts to write a piece of fiction, but then my own imagination seems to let me down, and so I you know, I kind of run out of narrative steam. I don't have a story waiting to burst forth from my brain into my fingertips. I don't know who does, but I don't, and so I think that's where I come out, is that when I sort of journal, it's less creatively satisfying. Now, that said, when I do write stuff down, and what I actually have going is a Google Doc that I just called Journal. Just every 6 weeks or 4 weeks or some very random time periods, I'll just open it up and really try to do this, because I know that even reading that 5 years from now, I will sort of astound myself with the level of detail.
And are you, I'm trying to remember, are you rewriting things that you've written in your notebook in that journal?
Or no.
Okay.
No, that's just, I just want to hammer out some life notes, biography style, usually.
Huh. And you're going to share that Google Doc in the show notes, right?
Yeah.
So, I think it's interesting that you keep saying mundane, because I think about this all the time. One of the early ideas for this show was about things that are mundane. And mm-hmm. The earliest one I think that I had was, I think they're called point of service terminals. Just knowing the word for the thing that you put your credit card in and press the numbers on. And then a few weeks ago, I was delighted to know the term gas door. And I was thinking about the whole thing again tonight, the mundanity, because as you know, and as interesting as this sounds, I found that it is not interesting when I go into detail. I, in order to wash my clothes the last few weeks, I have needed to bail the water out of my basement sink. And so I was writing about that in my notebook, and the phrase bailing out, like, it didn't sound completely right to me. And I found that there's something about writing about mundane things and then making sure, because they're mundane, I have to make sure that I've got the right words, because they're so boring that they're almost impossible to describe. And that is fun to me. Like, that feels creative, and it feels like I'm learning something, even if I'm just confirming that, yes, bailout is the right phrase, like bailing water out of something. There's something about that that I find valuable in the journal.
And of course, you're absolutely right.
Great.
Fantastic. Let's advance to our next segment. And this segment has just been blowing people's minds. So we're excited to bring it to you for a second week. This is Sticking With It, our new segment about the stuff we use, the stuff we enjoy that we've really stuck with. You know, us stationary enthusiast types tend to bounce from pen to pen, notebook to notebook, paper to paper, Kickstarter to Kickstarter. But in this groundbreaking new segment, we
talk about things we've already talked about.
All right, Adam, so I'm going to ask you, what is this week's Sticking With It? And before you start, let me preface by saying, share what you're sticking with it with on Twitter, if you'd like, with hashtag let me just check, what hashtag Sticking With It. That's no G.
No G. So I have been sticking with the Leutsch term 1917. I've been doing keeping my bullet journal in there. I've got a yellow one, and I think I may have discussed this before, but that is the purpose of Sticking With It. The bullet journal book suggests not bullet journaling with a Leutsch term for longer than 6 months before switching Leutsch terms, which, I mean, that sounds like a way to just sell more Leutsch terms. But but I was tempted. I'm going to try to stick with the Leutsch term. When I was in Boston, I was at Bob Slate Stationers. I was reminded of it because on not the most recent Erasable, but maybe the Erasable before that podcast, Tim, I think, was talking about being at Bob Slate as well. I bought the Leutsch term 1917 blue dotted grid. It is the Bauhaus Leutsch term edition. The edges of the paper are blue, and then there's a blue dot on the inside. There's also, I discovered, this is really not a Sticking With It, so this is a limited edition Leutsch term.
I feel like you are sort of undermining your sticking with it as you progress through this description.
Well, I'm sticking with, yes. I was just trying to make it interesting. I'm sticking with the Leutsch term, and I'm sticking with it to such a degree that I have bought the Leutsch term that I'm going to use in January, unless the current Leutsch term falls apart. And I did want to share this cool blue dotted grid edition, which for me is not even about the blue dot grid. It is about the blue line, the blue edges on the paper that you can see even so when the book is closed.
What is it about the Leutsch term 1917 that has kept you with it?
Well, I think it's the bullet journal that I'm sticking with. And then in the same way that we talked about the Jetstream being kind of a seamless pen, a pen that you don't even think about. You don't think about it as a pen. It doesn't. Thinking about the pen doesn't get in the way with writing on it. The Leutsch term is kind of the same way. You just open it up and you write in it, and there's not, maybe not to the degree of the Jetstream, but there's just a seamlessness to it. seems
nothing
to work.
Gets in your way.
Yeah, the only problem with my Lloyd's term is I'm doing the pen trick, which we've talked about on the show before, which does seem to warp the binding a bit, but not to the point that I've had to ditch the book early.
Well, this idea of design, I think the things that don't get in your way of sticking with them are I feel like there's a lot of design and engineering that goes into achieving that goal. You know, some of the notebooks we've talked about in the past, the pocket notebooks, your Word notebooks, your login jotters, they something about them, you know, and I'm comparing them in my mind always to the field notes, but something about them got in the way or hung you up. But I think this, what makes this sticking with it category are those things that where they've really just figured out some kind of really nice balance point. That's great.
Two questions for you, Ted.
Yes.
If people want to recommend two items they're sticking with, should they use the hashtag sticking with it, or should they use the hashtag sticking with them?
I would say both.
Okay. And then my second question, Ted, is what are you sticking with?
So this is my sticking with it this week is not actually a stationary product. It is it's headwear. I have been sticking with Ebbets Field Flannels, which is this fantastic company out of Seattle, Washington that makes, that reproduces old timey sports memorabilia and builds them in a really nice way and makes them in the USA and sells them. So I've had I got two of their baseball caps. One is for the the Fuji Athletic Club, which is a Japanese-American athletic club out of the Pacific Northwest in the 20s and 30s. Beautiful hat. And I've got a Houston Buffs hat, which is a minor league Houston baseball team. Amazingly well-crafted hats, comfortable on the head. Just beautiful, soft, silky interior lining. Everything is done just pitch perfectly, and they're fantastic hats. And so I stick with them. I love them. I love wearing them. I love the aesthetics qualities of them. I love the the way they feel on my head. They're fantastic. So Ebbets Field Flannels, I can't really say enough about. Oh, and incidentally, they make a. I'm going to have to look up the details, but they make a cap for an old Japanese baseball team owned by the Tombo company. Mm-hmm. The Tombo Bees, I want to say. Which it's actually
Tombo
I recommended.
Upside Down Flies or something.
I recommended it to, Tim Wasserman. He
memory.
Actually.
Sorry, just say that again. Say it again.
Which I actually tweet recommended to Tim Wasserman, and I was pleased to see that he actually purchased one. So anyway, Ebbets Field Flannels, that's my sticking with it.
Can we triple down on the erasable references? I've got the most recent erasable episode with Caroline Weaver as a guest was just fantastic. And she is sticking with it in a way that I wish I could. She talked on the show about when she has a sharpened pencil, she uses that sharpened pencil until she's done with it before moving on to another pencil. It made me feel like I was doing pencils wrong. So we will link
legend.
To both of these
legend
erasable
stems.
Episodes in the show notes. And we'll also link to Ted's recommendation of the Ebbets Field hats to Tim in the show notes as well. We probably will not do that.
Let's do this again, maybe in a couple weeks, Adam. What do you say?
Bon voyage, Ted.
Yeah, merci beaucoup.